During the October Blitz of 1944, Major Porter had told me the strange story of Robert Underhay and his wife Rosaline. They had separated, and shortly afterwards he had been reported dead in the African bush. She had married again, a multimillionaire, Gordon Claude, who was killed in an air raid, leaving her his vast fortune. But Underhay had hinted to the Major that he might give out that he was dead, and then reappear 1,000 miles away as Enoch Arden. And now, nearly 2 years later, a man had come to the village where Rosaline Claude was living and had registered at the local inn as Enoch Arden.
John Moffat as Hercule Poirot in Agatha Christie's Taken at the Flood.
A few days after his arrival, Enoch Arden had been found dead in his room at the inn, his head savagely beaten in. Major Porter had identified the body as that of his friend Robert Underhay, and the jury at the coroner's court had brought in a verdict of willful murder against Rosaline Claude's brother, David Hunter.
How do you mean, Monsieur Poirot? The case is all wrong.
None of it is, how shall I put it, Superintendent, the right shape.
Chief Inspector Japp always says you have a tortuous mind. How can a case not be the right shape?
The dead man, for instance, is all wrong.
What's wrong about him? Your Major Porter had no hesitation in identifying him as Robert Underhay.
Perhaps I am being fanciful, but consider this point. Underhay arrives at the Stag and writes a letter to David Hunter at Furrowbank, which he receives at breakfast time the following morning.
That is so.
And the moment he reads the letter, what does he do? He bundles his sister off to London.
That's understandable, surely. He wanted to have a clear hand to deal with things in his own way.
And then he calls on Enoch Arden, and Beatrice Lippincott just happens to overhear their conversation, and what is clear beyond a shadow of doubt is that David Hunter is far from certain whether the man is Robert Underhay or not.
You mean, why didn't the man say that he was Underhay straight out? I don't see anything odd about that. Respectable people who are doing something a bit crooked like to preserve appearances. You've got to allow for human nature.
Human nature. That is perhaps why I am so interested in this case. In the coroner's court, I was observing the Claude family, all of them dependent for so many years on the power and wealth of Gordon Claude. And what happens, Superintendent? What happens to the ivy when the oak round which it clings is struck down?
Well, that's hardly a question in my line. And in any case, the Claudes don't have anything to worry about. Now we're certain the man was Robert Underhay.
Are we certain? Rosaline Claude says she has never seen the man in her life. After all, a woman should know her own husband when she sees him.
Even so, as far as Rosaline Claude is concerned, isn't it worth her while not to recognize her first husband if a couple of £1,000,000 depends upon it? Besides, if he wasn't Robert Underhay, why was he killed?
That, Superintendent, is indeed the question.
A question I trust we shan't have to deal with. But you must excuse me, Monsieur Poirot. I must make my report to the Chief Constable.
I walked out into the little market square. In front of me was the Roman Catholic Church of the Assumption. Moved by I know not what impulse, I went in. A woman in a dark dress was kneeling, her head buried in her hands. Suddenly she got up and moved towards the church porch. It was Rosaline Claude.
Madame, can I help you?
No, no one can help me. They've taken David away to prison. I'm all alone.
No, madame, not entirely alone.
You were there today at the inquest, weren't you?
I was, madame.
I'm frightened. David told me I'd be safe as long as he was there to look after me. He said they all wanted me dead.
Madame.
No, you can't help me. No one can. I've got to bear the weight of my wickedness all alone. I'm cut off from the mercy of God.
No one is cut off from the mercy of God. You know that well, my child.
I'd have to confess my sins.
And can you not confess? You came here for that, did you not?
I came to get comfort. But what comfort is there for me? I'm a sinner.
We are all sinners, madame.
But I'd have to tell all the lies. All the lies I've spoken.
Lies about your husband? About Robert Underhay? Was it Robert Underhay who was killed?
It wasn't the body of my husband. It wasn't the least like him.
The dead man was not in the least like your husband?
No.
Then tell me, what was your husband like?
I'm not going to tell you.
And she rushed wildly out of the church. I walked slowly into the square and up the high street. In front of the Stag, I encountered Lynn Marchmont and Rowley Claude. He looked particularly pleased with himself.
I can't tell you how grateful we are, Monsieur Poirot. Conjuring Major Porter out of the blue like that. How you go about these things beats me. Anyway, it's going to make a lot of difference to our future married life.
How can you be so sure? There'll be all sorts of formalities to get through.
And when are you getting married?
In June.
And how long have you been engaged?
Nearly 6 years.
Lynn went into the Wrens.
And it is forbidden to marry in the Wrens?
I've been overseas.
Come on, Lynn. We must get going. I expect Monsieur Poirot wants to get back to town.
But I'm not going back to town.
What?
I'm staying on here at the Stag for a short while.
But why?
Oh, c'est un beau paysage.
Well, I can't imagine what you'll find to do here. Wormsley Vale is a rather one-horse sort of a place. Good luck.
Monsieur Poirot, do you think they were right to arrest David Hunter?
After the verdict of the jury, the police had no alternative.
But do you think he did it?
Do you, mademoiselle?
Do come along, Lynn. We must get back.
Goodbye, Monsieur Poirot. I hope we meet again.
I went into the Stag to arrange a room for myself. And then I thought I would pay a call on Dr. Lionel Claude. His wife did not seem exactly overjoyed to see me.
Yes, well, I suppose you'd better come in. Everything's in a bit of a muddle, I'm afraid. Please take a seat if you can find one. Oh, let me move. Madame Blavatsky, there.
Oh. Thank you.
You won't bring the word to my husband, will you, that I came and consulted you in London about the Underhay business?
No, my lips are sealed, madame.
I mean, I'd no idea that the man would actually turn up in Wormsley Vale that very same day. It was the most extraordinary coincidence.
It would certainly have been simpler if the Ouija board had directed you straight to the Stag.
Oh, the way things come about in the spirit world seems quite incalculable, but I do feel there is a purpose in it all.
That is very true. Even that I should sit here now in your drawing room, there is a purpose in that.
Is there really? Oh, yes, I suppose so. You're on your way back to London, of course.
Not at present. I am staying for a few days at the Stag.
At the Stag? Oh, but that's where... Oh, Monsieur Poirot, do you think that's wise?
I have been guided to the Stag.
Guided? What do you mean?
Guided by you, madame.
Oh, but I never meant... It's all so terrible, don't you think?
I have been talking to Rowley Claude and Miss Marchmont. They are getting married, I hear.
Dear Lynn, she's such a sweet girl. And Rowley is a splendid person, of course. But I think he became very bitter having to stay at home and look after the farm while all his friends were away at the war. And he used to get so angry when anyone suggested he was using the farm as an excuse for keeping out of it. He's got a ferocious temper sometimes. But it soon goes over. I hope he and Lynn manage to make a go of it.
6 years' engagement is a good test of affection.
Oh, I agree. But he must seem a little dull to a person who has seen so much of the world as Lynn has. Oh, but that's my husband coming. I hope he didn't hear me gossiping. Lionel, dear, here is Monsieur Poirot, who so cleverly brought Major Porter down to identify the body. It's wonderful, isn't it, how things do turn out for the best?
Even murder.
How do you do, Monsieur Poirot?
How do you do, Dr. Claude?
On your way back to London?
No, no. I remain at the Stag for a day or two.
Oh, police want to keep you here for a day.
Oh, no, no, no. It is my own choice.
Well, I must go and get us some tea. Mm-hmm. And there may be a little seed cake left.
Does this mean you're not satisfied with the verdict? You've got a feeling there's something wrong?
It is curious that you should say that. Do you feel that yourself, Doctor?
Well, hardly that.
Was there anything unsatisfactory about the medical evidence? Oh, I ask unofficially, of course.
No, I wouldn't say that.
But there is something you are not entirely certain about?
I've so little experience of police cases, you see. And anyway, medical evidence isn't the kind of hard and fast business that laymen and novelists seem to think. We're fallible. Medical science is fallible. What's diagnosis? A guess based on a very little knowledge and some indefinite clues that point in more than one direction.
Very like detection.
I'm pretty sound, perhaps, at diagnosing measles, because after all these years I've seen hundreds of cases. But I've known some queer things. I've seen a woman practically on the operating table, ready to have her appendix whipped out, and then paratyphoid diagnosed, just in time. The doctors, you know, are just as much victims of preconceived ideas as anybody else.
And in this case?
Here's a man, obviously murdered, lying with a bloodstained pair of fire tongs beside him. It would be nonsense to say he was hit with anything else. And yet, looking at his wounds, I'd have expected something rather different from fire tongs. Something with a more cutting edge.
Could he have fallen on some sharp object?
He was lying down in the middle of the floor on a good, thick, old-fashioned Axminster carpet. Anyway, the police surgeon was satisfied with the fire tongs, and, after all, he's the one that counts.
There was a cold east wind blowing, and I went back to my room at the Stag. But as I tiptoed up the stairs, I took the opportunity to peep into room number 5, where the man who had called himself Enoch Arden had died. There was nothing very remarkable about the room. A large brass double bed, an uninviting armchair, a heavy mantelpiece, and a solid marble fire curb with sharp square corners. It was chilly in my own room, and so I went down to the residence lounge. There was a cheerful-looking fire, and sitting beside it, a very formidable lady.
This lounge is reserved for people staying at the hotel.
I am staying at the hotel, madame.
But you're a foreigner.
Yes, madame.
In my opinion, you all ought to go back.
Go back where?
To where you came from. Oh. That's what we fought the war for, isn't it? Oh, I don't know what things are coming to. Oh, one good thing. They've closed down the aerodrome. It was disgraceful the way the girls right here used to go after the airmen. And what were they? Americans, Poles, oh, just riffraff. Man, mad the girls are nowadays. Faces covered in paint and powder, filthy stuff over their mouths, and bright red toenails.
Oh, yes, it is indeed deplorable, madame.
One of them put her head in here the other night. No hat on, hair tied up in an orange scarf and smothered in paint and powder. And what was she doing coming out of a man's bedroom, I should like to know? Disgusting.
Coming out of a man's bedroom?
Yes, that's what I said. Coming out of number 5.
What day was this, madame?
Oh, the day before there was all that fuss about a man being murdered. It's perfectly disgraceful that such a thing should happen here.
And what hour of the day was this?
Day? Which wasn't the day at all. No, past 10 o'clock at night it was. I was on my way up to my room, and out she comes from number 5 as bold as brass, stares at me and then dashes back inside again, laughing and talking with the man in there.
You heard him speak?
Well, that's what I'm telling you. Go on, get out of here, he says. I'm fed up with you. That's a nice way for a man to talk to a girl, but, oh, they ask for it, of course.
And you did not report this to the police?
I have never had anything to do with the police. Well, just imagine, me, Emily Ledbetter, in a police court.
Ça, c'est la fin, eh? Funny how often you come back to the old formula. We did have an indication all along that there might be a woman involved. This lipstick, was found under the chest of drawers in number 5.
Hmm. Good quality. A dark cherry red, worn probably by a brunette. Were there any fingerprints?
None.
And you've no doubt made your inquiries?
Oh, yes. If there really was a woman, it makes the case against David Hunter look distinctly shaky. Ah, he's finally condescended to give us an account of his movements, by the way.
What does he say?
He caught the 4:16 from London and got to Walmsley Heath at 5:50. He walked along the footpath to Furrow Bank and collected various items he'd left behind. Letters and papers and a checkbook.
And when did he leave?
At around 7:25. He realized he'd missed the 7:20 and that there wouldn't be another train until the 9:20. So he went off for a walk.
In which direction?
Just a minute. I've got it all written down here. Down Copse, Bats Hill, and Long Ridge. And when he was up at Long Ridge, he realized he was cutting it a bit fine for the 9:20, so he headed off to the station and caught the train by the skin of his teeth. He arrived back in London at 10:45 and was back at the flat around 11.
And do you have confirmation of any of this?
Remarkably little. Rowley Claude saw him arrive at Walmsley Heath, and Lynn Marchmont ran into him up by Marden Wood when he was running for the train.
Did anyone see him catch it?
No. But he telephoned to Miss Marchmont as soon as he got back to the flat.
That is checked?
Oh, yes. There was a toll call at 11:04 to the Marchmont number.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So unless your old lady dreamt it all, Arden was still alive at 10:10. He was either killed by the woman who dropped the lipstick, the woman with the orange scarf, or by somebody who came in after she left.
And you are certain that Hunter was back in London at 11:04?
Oh, yes. Lynn Marchmont has confirmed that he spoke to her.
A meeting in Marden Wood and a telephone call later that same night. I should very much like to know what was said.
The human interest side of things, eh, Monsieur Poirot? Yes, it's a fascinating business.
It was getting late, but I had one more call to make on Jeremy Claude. While I was waiting for him in his study, on the desk, I noticed a photograph of an aristocratic-looking gentleman on a horse.
My wife's father and one of his best horses came second in the Derby in 1924. Mm-hmm. What can I do for you, Monsieur Poirot? As a family, we owe you a debt of gratitude for finding Major Porter like that.
Oh, the family seems very jubilant about it.
Oh, yes, yeah, rather premature to my mind. A lot of water's got to pass under the bridge yet. After all, Underhay's death was accepted in Africa, and Rosalind's evidence was very positive. Couldn't say how a case would go. But you wanted to see me.
I came to ask you if you are really certain that your brother did not make another will subsequent to the one drawn up at the time of his marriage.
I'm pretty certain that he intended to make one. The will he made when he married Rosalind was a very brief document, revoking all previous testaments and leaving everything to her. It was uncharacteristically offhand, the act of an infatuated old man, I always thought. But I'm sure he didn't make another before leaving New York.
He could perhaps have done it during the 2 days he spent in London before his death.
Or drawn it up himself, you mean? But who'd have witnessed it?
Well, there were 3 servants living in the house. They died the same night that he did.
That's possible, I suppose. But wouldn't it have been destroyed with the rest of the house?
It might have been in a safe. Would you at least authorize me to make inquiries in London?
Oh, certainly. Very kind of you to undertake such a thing.
Monsieur Poirot. I didn't know you were still in Walmsley Vale. How kind of you to call on us.
Monsieur Poirot is going up to London to find out whether there's any possibility that Gordon made another will before he was killed.
Seems a very outside chance.
I might consult the ARP officials. I understand that Major Porter was one of the wardens for that area.
Who exactly is this Major Porter? Was he really in Africa?
Oh, certainly, madame. Why not?
I don't know. He puzzled me.
Yes, Mrs. Claude, I can understand that.
What do you mean?
I must take my leave. I shall only be in London for 24 hours at most. Then I shall return to the Stag, where you will find me, if you want me.
But why should we want to find you, Monsieur Poirot?
I did not feel that I needed to reply to her question. In London, I found nothing.
The house had been a total wreck and had been cleared away. But I was given the addresses of the next of kin of the three servants, the cook and butler from Dorset and the housemaid from County Cork. And then I took the opportunity to call on Major Porter. But there was a policeman standing outside the house, and in the hall was a very puzzled-looking Superintendent Spence.
How on earth did you get to hear of it, Monsieur Poirot?
Hear of what?
You mean you don't know?
No, what has happened? I simply came here to have a word with the Major.
I'm afraid that won't be possible. Major Porter has shot himself.
Huh? When did this happen?
Earlier this morning. They telephoned through to Walmsley Vale. I came up straight away.
Oh, the poor man. His conscience must have proved too strong for him.
Do you want to come up? He's just as we found him.
There is no question that it is suicide.
None whatsoever. Any idea why he should want to do it?
Yes. Oh, yes, there was a very good reason. That is not the difficulty.
It must have been about 3 hours ago. The woman of the house says he came back from the inquest yesterday in a terrible state. She heard him tramping up and down his room all night. She was out shopping when he did it.
Now, he seems to have been a neat and orderly man. Did he not leave any note, a letter for the coroner?
It's the sort of thing you'd expect a military man to do, I agree. But there was nothing.
It is very strange.
Bit of a blow for the clothes, this. It'll set them back. They'll have to hunt about for someone else who knew Underhay. And I don't imagine that will be easy.
It was after 8 o'clock when I got back to the Stag, where there was a note awaiting me from Frances Claude, asking if I would call and see her. I went round straight away.
You said that I might want to talk to you, Monsieur Poirot, and you were right, of course. There is something that must be told, and I think that you are the best person to tell it to.
It is always easier, madame, to tell a thing to someone who already has a very good idea what it is.
You think you know what I'm going to say?
Oh, yes.
Since when?
Since the moment I saw the photograph of your father in your husband's study. The features of your family are very strongly marked, particularly in the man who came here calling himself Enoch Arden.
He was my second cousin, somewhat the black sheep of the family. I never knew him very well, but we played together as children. And now I've brought him to his death, an ugly, sordid death.
Tell me the whole story, madame.
We were desperate for money. That's where the story begins. My husband was in serious financial trouble. Disgrace, perhaps imprisonment, lay ahead of him. Still does, for that matter. You must understand, Monsieur Poirot, that the plan I carried out was my plan. My husband had nothing to do with it. I had already applied to Rosaline for a loan. I don't know whether, left to herself, she would have given it to me or not, but her brother blocked it. He was in an ugly mood, and he was unnecessarily insulting, and that removed any scruples I might have had.
I understand.
My husband had repeated to me a rather interesting piece of information that he had overheard at his club.
Ah, yes, madame, I was there. Major Porter raised the possibility that Rosaline Claude's first husband might still be alive.
And it flashed through my mind that something might be managed by making use of that possibility. Charles Trenton, my cousin, was in this country and down on his luck. He'd been in prison, and I knew he wasn't a scrupulous person. I put the proposition to him. Of course, it was blackmail, neither more nor less. But we thought we had a good chance of getting away with it, and I didn't think that David Hunter would go to the police about it.
No, he does not greatly care for the police.
Charles could not, of course, definitely pretend that he was Robert Underhay. Rosalind would give that away in a moment. But luckily, she went to London, and that gave Charles the chance of suggesting that he might be Underhay. At first, David seemed to have fallen for it, but we should have known that he was a violent and dangerous person. And now Charles has been murdered, and but for me, he would still be alive. I sent him to his death. You can imagine what I have felt like ever since.
Nevertheless, your remorse did not prevent you from inducing Major Porter to identify the corpse as that of Robert Underhay.
No, I swear to you, I had nothing to do with that.
Huh?
We were dumbfounded when he gave evidence at the inquest. I still can't understand it.
But someone, and it could only have been one of your family, persuaded him or bribed him to identify your dead cousin as Underhay.
It was not I, and it was not Jeremy. Oh, I dare say you think that because I was ready to blackmail, I would stoop just as readily to fraud. No, Monsieur Poirot, I may have had no qualms about getting part of Gordon's money out of Rosalind, but I would never have tried to swindle her out of everything by manufacturing evidence that she was not Gordon's rightful wife at all. I could never do a thing like that, believe me.
Whoever did it will have it on their conscience for the rest of their lives. The Major shot himself this morning.
Oh, no.
Financially, he was in very low water, and when temptation came his way, he was unable to resist it. No doubt he regarded Rosaline Claude as a heartless little gold digger, and it might have given him satisfaction to put a spoke in her wheel.
And yet I couldn't help noticing he looked very unhappy at the inquest.
Au fond, he was an honest man, and very soon he would have to repeat his lie on oath. And his identifying the dead man as Underhay gave the jury a very potent motive to charge David Hunter with the murder.
He didn't say who.
He had his code. There was no reference as to who bribed him to commit perjury.
And so we are all back where we were.
So we are back where we started.
That, my friend, seems to be the general opinion. And now that there appears to be no doubt that Underhay died in Africa, Rosalind Claude's life is all that stands between the rest of the family and her husband's fortune. And she is afraid. Terribly afraid.
Do you honestly think that any of them would try to get rid of her?
I think this. Rosalind Claude is 26, and though mentally somewhat unstable, physically she's strong and healthy. She may live to be 70 or much more than that. 45 years, let us say, at the least. Now, do you not think that 45 years may be too long for someone to contemplate? No wonder the poor girl is afraid. She has reason to be.
In part four of Agatha Christie's Taken at the Flood, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat. Superintendent Spence, Robert Lang. Lynn Marchmont, Susanna Corbett. Frances Claude, Caroline Wilde. Jeremy Claude, Andrew Sachs. Kathy Claude, Elizabeth Proud. Lionel Claude, Johan Meredith. Rosalind Claude, Fritha Goody. Rowley Claude, Ivan Meredith. Mrs. Ledbetter, Mary Wimbush. Taken at the Flood is dramatized for radio by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.